for extra time. Thank you for being here again today, and I think the ones who've turned up again today after yesterday's onslaught of information deserve congratulations. I thought I wore you completely out yesterday, but you came back. Thank you. That's encouraging. So let's pick up where we left off last time. We've been studying, of course, the period between the Testaments, and last time we did the Grecian Empire and part of the Persian, and we brought ourselves up to the time that the Grecian Empire was divided into four parts, you remember, and one of those parts was the Seleucid Empire, which came to be the dominant force that led us up to Antiochus Epiphanes, you remember, at the very end last time. So we'll pick up there, do a little bit of review, and move ahead with what happens next during the time between the Testaments. Thank you for your good attention. Hope you can stay with me again today. I'm going to try to put two lessons into one again, one of which is the very last lesson in this series as we wind up and show why it is that this was, in fact, the fullness of times. So, welcome back today to the next class, and let's get going here. This lesson is entitled The Maccabean Revolt, named after the Maccabees family who led the revolt against the Seleucid Empire and Antiochus Epiphanes in particular. And so let's get right at it with a little bit of review. Here's our overview chart for this series of lessons. You see over here on the left-hand side is Malachi, the last prophet in the Old Testament, and way over here on the right, the book of Matthew, as we begin the New Testament. In between is a period of approximately 400 years in which God did not speak. During that time, we have the Persian reign, which was begun before Malachi and ended about 300 BC, and with the conquest by Alexander the Great, if you remember. He conquered the world in very short order and then was killed at a young age of 33. His generals divided up his empire, and finally the empire came to be divided primarily into the Egyptian portion. Anybody remember what that was called? The Ptolemaic Empire, after Ptolemy the First, and the Syrian Empire, otherwise known as the Seleucid Empire. Two of the generals of Alexander the Great, who became the dominant force in that part of the world. We didn't spend much time on the Egyptian part of this. We skipped that. But during that time, the Septuagint was translated, and many of the apocryphal writings were written down, to which we will refer today. In fact, I thought it would be useful for us today to spend some time just reading from some of those apocryphal books. How many of you in this class have ever read any portions of the apocryphal books? Raise your hand. Just two or three of you. Most of us have never read those books. We don't accept those as part of the canon of the Old Testament. Are you aware that the apocryphal books are all in the Old Testament? Even the ones accepted by the Roman Catholic Church, they're all in the Old Testament. There's some 14 of them that have been accepted as part of the canon by the Roman Catholic Church, and by the way, by the Orthodox Church, the Eastern Orthodox groups. They also accept those books as part of the canon. We do not, because we don't feel like they have the signs of inspiration. One of the other lessons in this series that we did this summer was a whole lesson just on those apocryphal books to explain why it is that they're not accepted in the canon by most Protestant groups, at least. Well, that's another whole lesson, isn't it? But we will refer to them today because they do supply us some of the interesting history of this period of time. Primarily the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees will be the ones to which we refer today. So those were written during this time period when the Ptolemies and the Seleucid Empire were sharing dominance. And notice the time frame. We're between 300, 200, and down to about 170 or so B.C. All right. So let's see what's next here. We ended up last time with one of the rulers of the Seleucid Empire called Antiochus Epiphanes, and that's where we'll pick up our study today. In revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes was the family called the Maccabees. Anybody know what that word means? Maccabee? It means the hammer. And so Judas Maccabeus was known as Judas the Hammer, and one who hammered out rebellion against the Seleucid Empire. Then a period of Jewish independence is the part we're talking about today. They declared their independence, and they were independent for about 100 years until the coming of the Roman Empire under a general named Pompey, who came and conquered that part of the world. All right, so here's a little review for you. You remember that the Empire of Alexander the Great was divided up into four major empires: the Seleucid, Lysimachus, Cassander, and Ptolemy. But these two guys up here didn't have much power and eventually were taken over by the Seleucids. So it really resolved itself into the Seleucid Empire, all of this up here, and the Ptolemaic Empire here to the south. And remember, in Daniel chapter 11, they were referred to as the king of the north. That would have been the Seleucids, the king of the south, the Ptolemies down here. And much was said about those in Daniel chapter 11, as you saw last time. Here was Ptolemy the first, as I showed you last time, the first great emperor or ruler of the southern portion of this kingdom. And here's Seleucus the first, Nicator of the northern kingdom. You saw those last time. Here's the northern empire as it came to its largest extent. This was the Seleucid Empire, and you can see it controlled a great portion of what was formerly Alexander's empire. And here is the infamous Antiochus Epiphanes, who came to rule over the Seleucids and was one of the most vicious, cruel, deceiving, despicable characters, called in Daniel chapter 11 this vile person who took over and did many awful things. He was a smooth talker. He knew how to get folks on his side and then stab him in the back. Yes, you do. He was a strong devotee of Hellenism. He imposed the Greek culture and worship on all his subjects. He saw Orthodox Hebrew religion as a strong foe against his Greek rule, and thus his intent was to crush the Jewish religion completely, and he tried everything he could to stamp them out, or either that or convert them to Hellenism. And Daniel, the 8th chapter, says he exalted himself as high as the Prince of Hosts, as if he were God himself. By him the daily sacrifices were taken away. You remember he stopped the sacrifices in the temple. The place of his sanctuary was cast down. His truth was cast down to the ground. Do you remember what was one of the great defilements that he perpetrated upon the temple? He offered pig and scattered pig broth over the whole place to defile it in the ultimate degree. It's called in the text the abomination of desolation. And literally that referred to the defilement of God's holy place, which of course later came to stand for in the New Testament, the abomination of desolation that came upon Jerusalem. You remember after Christ predicted the destruction of Jerusalem in Matthew 24. So that same reference in Daniel is repeated later. Okay, his goal was to destroy utterly all cultures and customs except those that were Greek. But he and his Hellenizing helpers went too far. They overreacted, and as a result, they perpetrated the rebellion that came next. I believe all of this was part of the unfolding of the fullness of time. Some horrible persecutions were perpetrated by Antiochus and his henchmen, and it is here where I'd like to share with you some of the readings from the book of Maccabees. So I know you don't have the Maccabees in front of you, so can't ask you to turn to this, but I will ask you to listen closely as Ron and I are going to share some readings here now. So your job for the next few minutes is to concentrate. Don't let your mind wander. I'm going to do the best I can to read with expression. My mother and dad always taught us kids, if you're going to read something, especially if you're going to read God's Word, read it with feeling and get the meaning from it. And when you read, folks ought to be able to understand what's being said. So I'm going to do my best. I know Ron will too as we read these. Now, these are not real familiar passages to us, so you be patient with us. But let's read a little bit about this period of time as described in the book of Maccabees. So as you see the reading there, we're going to begin in chapter 1 and verse 20. And by the way, these texts that were originally penned were all written by hand. You know this, don't you? All the original texts of both the Bible and all these ancient writings were all handwritten. And so to say, turn to chapter 1, verse 20, in the original writings, none of that was there. It wasn't in the Bible either. You know that. Things were written just one line after another with no punctuation, many times all capital letters, sometimes all small case letters. So it's very difficult reading back in those days. So we don't understand how blessed we are to have these books in such fine fashion. All right, let me read to you. Excuse me. This is referring to Antiochus Epiphanes. And it says, on his return from the conquest of Egypt in the year 143, Antiochus marched with a strong force against Israel and Jerusalem. And in his arrogance, he entered the temple and carried off the golden altar and the lampstand with all its equipment and the table for the bread of the presence. You remember what that was for? Table of the showbread. And the sacred cups and bowls and the golden censers, the curtain and the crowns. He stripped off all the gold plating from the temple front. He seized the silver, gold, and precious vessels and whatever secret treasures he found, and he took them all with him when he left his own country for his own country, and he caused much bloodshed, and he gloated over all he had done. Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, Ron, would you read that section for us? Chapter 1, 54 to 61.
On the 15th day of the month, Chislev, in the year 145, the king erected a horrible abomination upon the altar of holocausts, and in the surrounding cities of Judah they built pagan altars. They also burnt incense at the doors of houses and in the streets. Any scrolls of the law which they found, they tore up and burnt. Whoever was found with the scroll of the covenant and whoever observed the law was condemned to death by royal decree. So they used their power against Israel, against those who were caught each month in the cities. On the 25th day of each month, they sacrificed on the altar erected over the altar of holocausts. Women who had had their children circumcised were put to death in keeping with the decree, with the babies hung from their necks. Their families also, and those who had circumcised them, were killed. But many in Israel were determined and resolved in their heart not to eat anything unclean. They preferred to die rather than be defiled with unclean food or to profane the holy covenant. And they did die. Terrible affliction was upon Israel.
Did you catch that the women who had their children circumcised, their children were hung around their necks? And they were killed. In many cases, they were thrown off the precipice. You remember the temple was built on a high mountain? Remember one time Jesus went up on that mountain when he was tempted? And he said, cast yourself off, Satan did, and the angels will catch you. Well, they took the women and hung their babies around their necks and threw them off the temple. Many cases. There were so many horrendous things done by Antiochus Epiphanes to try to put out of existence even the thought of the Hebrew Orthodox religion. He was to eliminate it from the face of the earth. That was his goal. And what he did instead was stir up the souls of those who were determined to keep it. Now let's see. Let me read just this section from chapter 7 of 1 Maccabees. 1 Maccabees chapter 7. I'm going to read you verses 1 through 42 now. In the year 151... Demetrius, son of Seleucus, left Rome, landed with a handful of men at a town on the coast, and there made himself king. While he was traveling in the royal seat of his ancestors, the army seized Antiochus and Lysias, intending to hand them over to him. When this was reported to him, he said, "Do not let me set eyes on them." The soldiers accordingly put them to death, and Demetrius ascended to the throne. All the godless renegades, pardon me, this is 2 Maccabees. Thank you. I was reading the wrong thing. And that's a pretty interesting reading, too, but that's not what I wanted. 2 Maccabees chapter 7. Let me find my place now. Okay. This is another of the instances of the terrible persecutions that were perpetrated upon God's people. Again, seven brothers with their mother had been arrested and were being tortured by the king with whips and thongs to force them to eat pork. When one of them, speaking for all, said, "What do you expect to learn by interrogating us? We are ready to die rather than to break the laws of our fathers." The king was enraged and ordered great pans and cauldrons to be heated up, and this was done at once. Then he gave orders to the spokesman that the spokesman's tongue should be cut out and that he should be scalped and mutilated before the eyes of his mother and his six brothers. This wreck of a man the king ordered to be taken, still breathing, to the fire and roasted in one of the pans. As the smoke from it steamed out far and wide, the mother and her sons encouraged each other to die nobly. "The Lord God is watching," they said, "and without doubt has compassion on us. Did not Moses tell Israel to their faces in the song denouncing apostasy, 'He will have compassion on his servants'?" After the first brother had died in this way, the second was subjected to the same brutality. The skin and hair of his head were torn off, and he was asked, "Will you eat before we tear you limb from limb?" And he replied in his native language, "Never!" And so he in turn underwent the torture, and with his last breath he said, "Fiend though you are setting us free from this present life, and since we die for his laws, the king of the universe will raise us up to a life everlastingly made new." After him, the third was tortured, and when the question was put to him, he at once showed his tongue, boldly held out his hands, and said courageously, "The God of heaven gave me these. His laws mean far more to me than they do, and it is from him that I trust to receive them back." When they heard this, the king and his followers were amazed at the young man's spirit and his utter disregard for suffering. When he too was dead, they tortured the fourth in the same cruel way. At the point of death, he said to the king, "Better to be killed by men and cherish God's promise to raise us up again. There will be no such resurrection to life for you." Then the fifth was dragged forward for torture. Looking at the king, he said, "You have authority over men, mortal as you are, and can do as you please, but do not imagine that God has abandoned our race. Wait and see how his great power will torment you and your descendants." Next, the sixth was brought and said with his dying breath, "Do not delude yourself. It is our fault that we suffer these things. We have sinned against our God and brought these appalling disasters upon ourselves. But do not suppose you will escape the consequences of trying to fight against God." The mother was the most remarkable of all and deserves to be remembered with special honor. She watched her seven sons all die in the space of a single day, and yet she bore it bravely because she put her trust in the Lord. She encouraged each in turn in her native language. Filled with noble resolution, her woman's thoughts fired by a manly spirit, she said to them, "You appeared in my womb, I know not how. It was not I who gave you life and breath and set in order your bodily frames. It is the Creator of the universe who molds man at his birth and plans the origin of all things. Therefore, he, in his mercy, will give you back life and breath again, since now you put his laws above all thought itself." Antiochus felt that he was being treated with contempt and suspected insult in her words. The youngest brother was still left, and the king, not content with appealing to him, even assured him on oath that the moment he abandoned his ancestral customs, he would make him rich and prosperous by enrolling him as the king's friend and entrusting him with high office. Since the young man paid no attention to him, the king summoned the mother and urged her to advise the lad to save his life. After much urging from the king, she agreed to persuade her son. She leaned towards him, and flouting the cruel tyrant, she said in their native language, "My son, take pity on me. I carried you 9 months in the womb, suckled you 3 years, reared you and brought you up to your present age. I beg you, child, look at the sky and the earth, see all that is in them, and realize that God made them out of nothing, and that man comes into being in the same way. Do not be afraid of this butcher. Accept death
and prove yourself worthy of your brothers, so that by God's mercy I may receive you back again along with them. She had barely finished when the young man spoke out. What are you waiting for? I will not submit to the king's command. I obey the command of the law given by Moses to our ancestors. And you, King Antiochus, who have devised all kinds of harm for the Hebrews, you will not escape God's hand. We are suffering for our own sins, and though to correct and discipline us as our living God is angry with us for a short time, yet he will again be reconciled to his servants. But you, impious man, foulest of the human race, do not indulge vain hopes or be carried away by delusions of greatness, you who lay hands on God's servants. You are not yet safe from the judgment of the Almighty, all-seeing God. My brothers have now fallen in loyalty to God's covenant after brief pain leading to eternal life. But you will pay the just penalty of your insolence by the verdict of God. I, like my brothers, surrender my body and my life for the laws of our fathers. I appeal to God to show mercy speedily to his people, and by whips and scourges to bring you to admit that he alone is God. With me and my brothers may the Almighty's anger be justified, and which has justly fallen on all our race, and may it be soon ended. The king, exasperated with these scornful words, was beside himself with rage. So he treated him worse than the others. The young man died, putting his whole trust in the Lord without having incurred defilement. Then finally, after her sons, the mother died. This, then, must conclude our account of the eating of the entrails and the monstrous outrages that accompanied it. Now, we don't know, in the case of the Maccabees, how much of that is literal truth. But surely there must have been truth to this. And there were many outrages perpetrated upon God's people by Antiochus Epiphanes, the glorious one, who looked upon himself as some kind of the savior of all mankind. As a result, they stirred up a revolt among the Jews, which ultimately led to an independent Jewish state. Antiochus Epiphanes did not know who he was fooling with. And may it ever be so, that with God's people, you can perpetrate whatever terrible things you wish, but they will stand for what's right. So the Maccabean Revolt, 166 to 134 B.C., officially began with the incident at Modin by the priest Mattathias, 166 B.C. Are you ready for this one, Ron? Let's read a little bit about the original event of the Maccabean Revolt. The high priest Mattathias. Maccabees, 1 Maccabees chapter 2.
Mattathias and his sons. In those days, Mattathias, son of John, son of Simeon, a priest of the family of Joarib, left Jerusalem and settled in Modane. He had five sons: John, who was called Gaddai; Simon, who was called Thasai; Judas, who was called Maccabeus; Eleazar, who was called Abiram; and Jonathan, who was called Apphus.
They all had nicknames. Five boys to this great priest.
Now, verse 15.
Yes.
The officers of the king in charge of enforcing the apostasy came to the city of Modane to organize sacrifices. Many of Israel joined them, but Matthias and his sons gathered in a group apart. Then the officers of the king addressed Matthias.
That's Mattathias.
Mattathias.
Mattathias, yeah.
You are a leader, an honorable and great man in this city, supported by sons and kinsmen. Come now, be the first to obey the king's command, as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those who are left in Jerusalem have done. Then you and your sons shall be numbered among the king's friends and shall be enriched with silver and gold and many gifts. But Mattathias answered in a loud voice, although all the Gentiles in the king's realm obey him, so that each forsakes the religion of his fathers and consents to the king's orders, yet I and my sons and my kinsmen will keep to the covenant of our fathers. God forbid that we should forsake the law and the commandments. We will not obey the words of the king, nor depart from our religion in the slightest degree. As he finished saying these words, a certain Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice on the altar in Modane, according to the king's order.
Let me pause just a moment. If you didn't catch that, he was asking the Jews to offer sacrifice in every city. And the sacrifice was, guess what? A pig. And then they were going to be asked to eat the pig's entrails. That's part of this subjection to the Greek system and total rejection of the Jewish system. So go ahead.
When Mattathias saw him, he was filled with zeal. His heart was moved, and his just fury was aroused. He sprang forward and killed him upon the altar. At the same time, he also killed the messenger of the king, who was forcing them to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. Thus he showed his zeal for the law, just as Phinehas had did with Zimri, son of Salu.
Let's pause there a minute. Do you remember Phinehas in the Old Testament? Does this ring a bell, anybody?
He's a high priest.
He was so upset with the adulterous behavior of the Israelites. You remember he drove a spear through the man and the woman who were committing adultery and pinned them to the ground? That's the reference maker. Mattathias killed the Jew who was about to offer a pig. And then he killed the king's emissary and tore down that altar in his fury over their daring to defile God's people that way. Go ahead.
Then Mattathias went through the city shouting, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and who stands by the covenant follow after me." Thereupon he fled to the mountains with his sons, leaving behind in the city all their possessions.
So this great event at Modane was the beginning of the rebellion of the Maccabees. Mattathias and his five boys and everybody that would follow them fled to the mountains and began guerrilla warfare against the emissaries of Antiochus Epiphanes. So you're with me here now? This is the beginning. Mattathias and his five sons, who came to be called then the Maccabees, after Judas Maccabeus, the hammer, as they sent their armies out to attack. The last of these sons, Simon, was killed in 134 B.C. So that's why we say, from the time of Mattathias' great event here in 166 to the death of Simon, 134, that was the period of the Maccabean revolt. A lot of things happened in those 30 years. I will have only just a moment here to tell you about a few of those things. Mattathias and the Hasadeans. Let me read to you from chapter 2, verse 42 to 48. This is interesting because this marks a part of the beginning of one of the sects of the Jews. It was then that they were joined by a company of Hasadeans, stalwarts in Israel, every one of them a volunteer in the cause of the law. And all who were refugees from the troubles came to swell their numbers and so add to their strength. Now that they had an organized force, they turned their wrath upon the guilty men and renegades. Those who escaped their fierce attacks took refuge with the Gentiles. See, once they got a big enough army, they went around and started killing all the Jews who had given in to the Greeks. So we're not putting up with this. The Hasadeans. Let's see how far we're going to get. Mattathias and his friends then swept through the country, pulling down the pagan altars and forcibly circumcising all the uncircumcised boys found within the frontiers of Israel. They hunted down their arrogant enemies, and the cause prospered in their hands. And thus they saved the law from the Gentiles and their kings and broke the power of the tyrant. Hasadeans, the precursors to the, what sect do you think? The strictest sect of the Jews. The Pharisees. These are the precursors of the Pharisees. And let me tell you, at the beginning of their existence, the Hasadeans were to be admired. They stood up for what was right and were willing to fight for the Lord, even against their own people who had deserted and given up what God told them to do. So the Hasadeans originally were to be admired. Over time, they came to be a sect that even turned against Jesus Christ. And in their strictness, they lost the idea of who they were. That can happen to us too, beloved. Can I tell you? Among churches of Christ, in our strictness, sometimes we can lose who we are. And we get out of balance as we emphasize the minor things and forget the weightier things. Isn't that what Jesus warned the Pharisees about? That can happen to the strictest sect. God forbid we're a sect, but may we always try to keep our balance. So I thought you ought to hear about the Hasidim. Matthias' last words to his son, he's an old man now, he's ready to die. I want you to listen as Ron reads us the last words of Matthias to his boys, his five sons. Go ahead.
When the time came for Matthias to die, he said to his sons, "Arrogance and scorn have now grown strong. It is a time of disaster and violent anger. Therefore, my sons, be zealous for the law and give your lives to the covenant of your fathers. Remember the deeds that our fathers did in their times, and you shall win great glory and an everlasting name. Was not Abraham found faithful in trial, and it was reputed to him as uprightness? Joseph, who in distress kept the commandment, and he became master of Egypt. Phinehas, our father, for his burning zeal, received the covenant of an everlasting priesthood. Joshua, for executing his commission, became a judge in Israel. Caleb, for bearing witness before the assembly, received an inheritance in the land. David, for his piety, received as an inheritance a throne of everlasting royalty. Elijah, for his burning zeal for the law, was taken up to heaven. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael, for their faith, were saved from the fire."
Who's that?
Meshach,
Meshach, and Abednego. These were their Jewish names, weren't they? Go ahead.
"Daniel, for his innocence, was delivered from the jaws of lions. And so, consider this from generation to generation, that none who hope in him shall fail in strength. Do not fear the words of a sinful man, for his glory ends in corruption and worms."
I love that. Mine says his glory ends in filth and worms. Don't worry about him. Go ahead.
"Today he is exalted, and tomorrow he is not found, because he has returned to his dust, and his schemes have perished. Children, be this is a very small print.
Yeah, I know it.
be courageous and strong in keeping the law. For by it you shall be glorified. Here is your father Simeon, here's your brother Simeon, who I know is a wise man. Listen to him always, and he will be a father to you. And Judas Maccabeus, a warrior from his youth, shall be the leader of your army and direct the war against the nations. You shall also gather about you all who observe the law, and you shall avenge the wrongs of your people. Pay back the Gentiles what they deserve, and observe the precepts of the law."
Good deal. By the way, he has a different version than I do.
Yeah, different.
Mine is the New English Bible. See, they've also translated the apocryphal books into different versions in English, just like we have our Bibles. So our reading's a little different. So he reminded them of all these great heroes of faith of old, and he said, "You be like them. Stand up for what's right. Defend the people against these awful Gentiles." Three great victories under Judas Maccabeus, the hammer, Apollonius from Samaria, Siron from Syria, and Lysias, the great field general, with Nicanor and Gorgias. You know, Antiochus thought, this little fly on the wall, I'm going to go down there and spit on him, and he'll be gone. So he sent that first army, and Judas Maccabeus defeated them terribly. So then he sent a bigger one, and he defeated them terribly. And then he sent his third one with Lysias, his major general. And by the grace of God, Judas Maccabeus defeated him as well. It was terrible, crushing defeats for Antiochus at the hands of Judas Maccabeus. And when that came to an end, and these three great victories, Judas Maccabeus returned with his armies to Jerusalem to purify the temple. Now I'm going to read to you from Josephus. Who knows about him? Yes, sir. Tell us a little bit.
Well, he's a historian of the Jews. He's covered clear back through the silent period and clear into the destruction of Jerusalem.
Correct. Josephus was a Jew himself. He lived in the first century. and he wrote the history of the Jews from creation all the way through the destruction of Jerusalem and beyond. And so this book, written in the first century, is a good source of history and includes the history of the time between the Testaments. So here's his rendering of the events that took place after Judas Maccabeus had these three great victories and returned to Jerusalem. So I'm in the Antiquities of the Jews, book 12, chapter 7, section 6. Now I'll read you a little bit here. When therefore the generals of Antiochus' armies had been beaten so often, Judas assembled the people together and told them that with the many victories which God had given them, they ought to go up to Jerusalem and purify the temple and offer the appointed sacrifice. But as soon as he, with the whole multitude, was come to Jerusalem and found the temple deserted, and its gates burned down, and plants growing in the temple of their own accord, on account of its desertion, he and those that were with him began to lament and were quite confounded at the sight of the temple. You can imagine. They just cried. So he chose out some of his soldiers and gave them order to fight against those guards that were in the citadel, until he should have purified the temple. When therefore he had carefully purged it, and had brought in new vessels, the candlestick, the table of showbread, the altar of incense, which were made of gold, he hung up the veils at the gates and added doors to them. He also took down the altar of burnt offering and built a new one of stones that he gathered together, and not of such as were hewn with iron tools. And so on the 25th day of the month of Chislev, 5 and 20th, the 25th day of Chislev. You know what month that is, Brad?
December.
Yes. Which the Macedonians called Apuleius, they lighted the lamps that were on the candlestick. Stay with me here. And offered incense upon the altar, and laid the loaves upon the table of showbread, and offered burnt offerings on the new altar. Now it so fell out that these things were done on the very same day on which their divine worship had fallen off and was reduced to a profane and common use after 3 years' time. For so it was that the temple was made desolate by Antiochus and continued for 3 years. You remember I told you about his desolation, about the abomination of desolation? You remember that was done on the 25th of December of the month of Chislev. 3 years later, Judas Maccabeus is back, and they're now doing what's proper in the temple again. This desolation happened to the temple in the 145th year on the 25th day of the month of Apuleius, or Chislev. I wonder what was going on here. That was a child flipping buttons back then. On the 153rd Olympiad, but it was dedicated anew on the same day, on the 25th month Apuleius, in the 148th year, and on the 154th Olympiad. See, Josephus tries to give you the dates from the Jewish standpoint, and from the Roman standpoint, and from the Greek standpoint in his book. And this desolation came to pass according to the prophecy of Daniel, which was given 408 years before, for he declared that the Macedonians would dissolve that worship for some time. Didn't we read that in Daniel chapter 11? Mm-hmm. Yes, we did.
He also dates the book, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. He dates the book for us. Now, of course, critics disagree. They say Josephus didn't know what he was talking about, but this is another support that the book of Daniel was written hundreds of years prior to the events that it prophesied. Josephus. Well, let's see. I think I have a slide here now about this particular celebration. This came to be called the Feast of Dedication on the 25th of December. Did you know that Jesus went to the Feast of Dedication? Why don't you open to John chapter 10? John 10, verse 22. This feast, ladies and gentlemen, is nowhere commanded in the Old Testament. This was an additional feast that came during the period between the Testaments, and it was a celebration of the purifying of the temple after the Maccabean revolt. And it came to be a regular feast day that was celebrated in honor of this great rebellion. John 10. Somebody have it?
dedication in Jerusalem. It was winter.
And that's it. Is that all that verse says?
That's all it says.
Why don't you back up a little bit and get into it? What does it say right before you?
Others said they are not in the words of one who is a demon.
Okay, never mind. It's just a feast of dedication, right? And then what does it say right after?
And after it says, then Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch.
Okay, so you see it says the feast of dedication, and it was winter. What's the date of the feast of dedication? December 25th. Interesting, isn't it? We have a famous day on December the 25th, don't we? That came to be a, quote, Christian holiday, supposedly celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ. Do we know when Christ was born, ladies and gentlemen?
No.
Folks, we don't, not only do we not know the day, we don't know the month, we don't even know the year. Did you know that? You can't establish any of those from Scripture. In fact, it is highly unlikely that Christ was born in the winter time, because there were shepherds out in the fields watching their flocks by night. You think they'd be doing that on December the 25th? Highly unlikely. So where in the world did this come from? It's a long and interesting study as to how Christianity, quote, developed this feast time called Christ Mass, of which the Bible says nothing. And yet it's been established based on an awful lot of really just thinking of men, because God said nothing about it. We were never told to celebrate the birth of Christ, and certainly we don't know when it is. At any rate, that's a sidelight. There is a Jewish feast called the Feast of Dedication, to which Jesus went, John chapter 10, in the wintertime. I don't know if he celebrated that feast or not, but he was there. Anybody know what this feast has come to be called in our day? What do the Jews celebrate around the same
Hanukkah.
Hanukkah. That's the feast. 25th of Kislu, our December, the modern day Hanukkah.
It's called the Festival of Lights. 47 B.C. when they started that?
He said it was on the 25th day of the 148th year. And the 154th Olympiad. That's what he said. That's Josephus' antiquity. Now it's called the Festival of Lights in Josephus, and the reason is, remember what he did when he got there and cleaned out the temple? What's the first thing he did? He lit the lights. And see, the tradition is that he only had enough light to burn for about one day, but that instead it continued burning for a whole week without being replenished. And of course, that's claimed to be a great miracle, that the lights continued to be lit even though they didn't have enough oil to keep them lit. That's the Feast of Lights. There's traditions then of the Hanukkah lamp that are celebrated even to this day among the Jewish community. Well, where did that start? Between the Testaments, after the Maccabean revolt. Isn't this interesting? I don't know why people don't want to study this. It's fascinating. And does it impact our understanding of the New Testament? It absolutely does. All right, that's the end of that one, so let me get set up for the next one here now. Of course, there are many other lessons that should be done here that we simply don't have time to do. And so what we will do now is pick up this last lesson, which I've entitled The Fullness of Time, and go back to Galatians 4, chapter 4, verse 4. Understand, of course, that what I have done is skipped, let's see, about 10 lessons here. So we're going to the end, because we're about out of time. Galatians 4 and verse 4 says, but when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of a woman, born under the law. It's interesting to me the way God says that. Born of a woman. Do you think there's emphasis there?
Genesis 3:15.
Yeah. Which was the promise that of you and your seed would come one who would crush the head of the serpent. It was not man's seed, was it? It was of a woman. There was no man involved here. Right?
Right.
God was the Father. She conceived of the Holy Spirit. He was born of a woman. That in itself was a dramatic statement, folks. You understand? It implied the miracle, but it also implied that through a woman came the Savior of the world by the agency of God. Does that give a woman a significant role? And then, born under the law. What law?
Moses.
In that case, the law of Moses. Jesus Christ was born and lived his entire life, did he not? Under the law of Moses, which he kept perfectly, as no one ever had before or since. He was a Jew on earth. Don't forget that. And he lived according to Jewish law. And at the time God chose is when he was born of a woman. It was the fullness of time. Now, for the next few minutes, what I want to try to illustrate to you is some reasons that seem to me to fall out of the period between the Testaments that demonstrate why this was the fullness of time. I'm sure there are many others, but these are ones that I have come up with my studies of Nod, with other, obviously, listening to other people and thinking and meditating. Why was this the fullness of time? Let's talk about it for a few minutes. I'll try to illustrate some things that I think teach us that. What things have we learned in our study that would suggest the conditions were right for the Lord's coming? And of course, our study was 17 lessons. Yours was just a few. So I understand you're at some disadvantage here, but I'm asking, what did our study suggest? What things happened in history, in culture, in religion, that made this the right time for the spread of Christianity? I think that's why God sent him. That was why it was the fullness of time. Because it was the right time for these things to spread.
It was also prophesied.
That's right. There you go. It was prophesied. That's the first thing you can say. It was prophesied. Thank you. Where was it prophesied? Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. And let's review just quickly, shall we? You tell me. What's first? In the image. The head of gold, right? And what was the first beast? Remember? You were supposed to have a quiz on this. It was the lion with wings on its back, remember? And that, of course, was representative of the great King Babylon, as Daniel 2 tells us. Then there was the breast and arms of silver. And what was the beast that correlated to that? A bear with three ribs in its mouth and crushing them and went about and did a great deal of damage. And, of course, we're told in the 8th chapter of Daniel who that was, aren't we? And that's the Medes and the Persians. It was imaged in Daniel 8 as a, what? A ram with two horns, one higher than the other, you remember? And then there's the belly and thigh of bronze. And remember what the beast looked like? Yeah. It was a leopard. Think of Alexander the Great leaping across the world with lots of wings on his back. Representative then of Greece, wasn't it? As we're clearly told in Daniel chapter 8, where there was this ram, this goat with a great horn who went to attack the ram and beat him up. And then there was the legs of iron and the feet part of iron and clay. And then there was this fourth dreadful beast, which we have no idea what he looked like. That is a terrible image. I don't think that's what he looked like at all. Looked more like a dinosaur, and which, of course, was indicative of the Roman Empire. And what did God say in Daniel 2? In the days of these kings shall God establish a kingdom which will never be destroyed. Same over there with that fourth kingdom. That's the kingdom in which God would have his son, the Son of Man, rise up and go before the Ancient of Days, you remember? And be given a kingdom and authority and power and dominion. So that is right. It was prophesied first in Daniel that in the days of the Roman Empire, this would happen. But how long did the Roman Empire last? Hundreds and hundreds of years. So that doesn't narrow it down too much. So we need more than that. It was in the days of the Roman Empire. And let me tell you a little bit about that. These are some of the lessons we skipped. Augustus Caesar declared himself to be the first emperor. His name was Octavian. He called himself Augustus, which means the majestic. So what else is new, right? Deserving of all glory and honor, and expected folks to worship him as did many of the other Caesars. 27 BC to AD 14 was the rule of Augustus Caesar in the Roman Empire. As the Roman Empire is born out of a long history, we did two lessons on the Roman Empire to bring us up to where we were. Does anybody remember, just for interest's sake, what's the original story of where the Roman Empire came from? It's a myth.
Romulus.
What do you know about Romulus and Remus? They were twin boys who were suckled by a wolf. In fact, if you go to Rome, you'll see a great statue there in the right place of a wolf and two boys sucking on her underneath, Romulus and Remus, because the myth is that they were the boys who originally established Rome as an empire. Kind of interesting, it's a myth. But the empire really wasn't born until Augustus Caesar, who defeated, if you remember, the others who were out after the throne, Mark Antony and Cleopatra, defeated at the great battle of Actium. All right. Luke, the second chapter, makes reference to this. It's a passage so familiar, it's read every Christmas. And in the days of Caesar Augustus, right, that went forth the decree, what? That people should be numbered, taxed, and therefore they had to go where? Back to their own homeland, to their own home city. And that's why Joseph took his pregnant wife Mary, and they went back to Bethlehem because of the decree of Caesar Augustus. So this is where the New Testament begins, isn't it? Good. Now, I'm telling you, the days of the Roman Empire, in this particular time, it was a time of unprecedented peace and stability in the Mediterranean world. You don't have any idea, if you haven't studied the time between the Testaments, how unstable everything was. But once Rome took over, you had a long period of stability. I'm convinced that's a large reason why this was the fullness of time. Rome controlled the Mediterranean Sea, and sea travel was safer than ever before in that whole period of time. Here's a picture of how much the Mediterranean they controlled. See, they control all of this, all around here. You may remember that there was a great empire down here in northern Africa. Anybody have to remember what empire that was? Came and fought against the Romans? Carthage. Good for you. Congratulations. You remember their great general's name? Hannibal. And he rode on elephants. Remember? He tracked those elephants all the way across the top, and there was this great battle up there where the Romans defeated Carthage and took over the Carthaginian Empire down here. And so they controlled all of this part around the Mediterranean. In fact, the Romans came to call that our sea. Not the Great Sea, but our sea. And it was much so. They controlled it. All right. So that was one reason. Another is Rome built a system of roads and patrolled them with their armies. Land travel was safer than it had ever been at that time. You think that might provide a way by which God's message could be spread? With relative safety, relative to what had been before. In fact, I have a picture here of some of the Roman roads that still exist today. As they expanded their control, the Romans built an excellent network of roads, some of which were so wonderfully built, and I have several slides about that. We did a long study about this Roman road system that shows you what an excellent job they did building roads. And here's a network of the roads, if you can see it. See all these roads, the blue lines? They built roads everywhere so you could travel with ease across that part of the world. All those blue lines are roads. Thousands upon thousands of miles of roads. And we have an interstate system, right? It took us a long time to build it. Well, so did this. And much longer, because they did it in a very tedious way, layer after layer after layer, so that it would last. Amazing. And here we are 2,000 years later, and some of those roads are still there. So, I think that was another reason that it was the fullness of time. The Roman Empire established a method by which people could travel for relative safety. Now, after the second chapter, we'll not have time to go to this, but if you remember the people gathered in Jerusalem for the day of what? Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. And you remember it gives a list of where they were from? They were from all over the known world. And they all gathered in Jerusalem for the day of Pentecost. Look, folks, they couldn't have been there that day had it not been for this Romans. And God chose that day, didn't he, to announce for the first time the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ to all those people from all over the world. The great day. So Jews from every nation under heaven, remember in Acts 11, after the persecution arose, they scattered and they went as far as Cyprus and Cyrene. Do you know what Cyprus is? It's an island in the Mediterranean. Guess how they got there? By Roman ships in relative safety. And they were able to travel to the other parts of the world in relative safety on Roman ships. Or by roads up to Antioch of Syria, where they established that great congregation from which the gospel spread all over the then known world. And of course, 13 to 28 of Acts tells about Paul's great journeys as he took the gospel to the whole world. Do you think Paul's the only one to travel? You better not. Were all the apostles told to take the gospel to the whole world? They were. And I can tell you there are traditions all over the then known world that this apostle came here. Do you know which apostle was supposed to have gone to India? Well, I'll let you go look that up. Do you know which apostle was supposed to have gone to Romania, where I lived for 2 years? No, we don't know that either. Andrew is said to have gone to Romania. That's the tradition. I don't know that we have any definite records that prove that. The Bible certainly doesn't tell us. But I believe the 12 apostles all eventually scattered. Do you know where Peter ended up, according to tradition? No, he stayed in Jerusalem at first, yes. But he is said to have ended up in Rome, just like Paul did, and was killed in Rome as well as Paul. That's tradition. And therefore, they have this great, what's it called?
Basilica.
The Basilica of Peter and Paul, built in Rome as the central headquarters for the Roman Catholic Church. Anyway, that's all thrown in free of charge. Greek civilization had great impact on why this was the fullness of time. The Greek language, beautiful and musical, power to express and captivate, became the universal language. God used the Septuagint version of the Old Testament to get his word around to the whole world, because what language was spoken everywhere then? Greek. Septuagint was in the Greek, and it was a translation of the Old Testament written originally in Hebrew and Aramaic, but translated into the to Greek in the Septuagint version, in the period between the Testaments, and certainly quoted by the apostles and Jesus Christ. God used this language to reveal his word in the New Testament. That's another reason it was the fullness of time. So the Greek culture had tremendous impact on why Jesus came when he did. The Septuagint version of the Old Testament was widely disseminated. Many Jews spoke Greek, and Gentiles now could read about the mighty works of God in their own language. And when Paul went to all these places, did he find Gentiles who already knew about God? Yes, he did. How did they know about Jehovah? In large measure, through the Septuagint version of the Old Testament and the spread of Jews all over the then known world. Quoted in the New Testament, by Jesus and his apostles. Part of the fullness of time, folks. Through the Old Testament scriptures and Jewish influence, many Gentiles knew Jehovah. Namely, one Gentile that absolutely for certain in the book of Acts knew about Jehovah God. Cornelius. That's the one I have to pick out. Acts 10 and 11. Wasn't he said to have known God? And he prayed to God always? Gave alms? And this was Jehovah God, that passage. How do you know that? Well, it's the fullness of time. Now, I've talked about how the Romans impacted it. I've talked about how the Greeks impacted it. Remember I told you about all those threads? Now let's talk about how the Israelite nation impacted the fullness of time. Didn't God promise to Abraham that he would preserve a remnant and that through them he would bring a descendant, he would bring blessings to all the families of the earth? Israelites were scattered through the whole world, weren't they? The Assyrian conquest, the Babylonian conquest, the Grecian conquest, the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, every one of them scattered them. So did the Romans, by the way. They scattered Jews everywhere also. So there were Jews all over the then known world. Guess where people went first when they spread the gospel? To the Jews first, to their synagogue. and then to the Gentiles. So there was a natural beginning in the fullness of time for the spread of the gospel. So scattered throughout the world, synagogues in many cities, they read the scriptures every week, didn't they? In fact, every day. The gospel was preached first to the Jews and then to the Gentiles. Even the sects of the Jews, folks, were a part of the fullness of time. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots, the Herodians, these too played a role in the fullness of time. Give me some idea. We did whole lessons on these. We don't have time for that. But give me some idea of how they helped the fullness of time. Don't make it hard. Aren't they the very ones that spoke against Christ and brought him before Pilate and wanted him to die, rebelled against him? God used those sects of the Jews to be the very ones that rebelled against God and his only begotten Son. Remember in those parables when he said, I sent you this servant, I sent you that servant, and I finally sent my only son, and what did you do with him? You killed him and mistreated him. And your judgment is certain. So they played a part in the fullness of time. So when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, that we might receive the adoption. And I hope that makes you weep. Because God had a plan. And his plan, Christ came. And all of this we've been talking about was perpetrated in such a way as to bring us to the perfect time when God would bring his son into the world. So that we might receive the adoption. God be praised. Now, I was going to quote you from The History of the Christian Church by Philip Schaff, but I can't find the book. I didn't bring it with me. There's a wonderful quote in that book that kind of summarizes everything we've said. And he says it in such an eloquent fashion that I wish maybe you could find it for him one of these days and print it out and give it to him. It's Schaff's own, as he looked at the history of the whole Christian church, his own perception of how this was the fullness of time. It's just a wonderful quote. So I'll leave that for you to investigate on your own and say just with you, praise be to God for his marvelous unfolding.